From T.C. McLuhan's book, Touch the Earth, a statement by Red Jacket, a Seneca chief and orator of the Six Nation Confederacy. He was asked in the 1800s why he was so opposed to missionaries. Here's his reply.
They do us no good. If they are not useful to the white people and do them no good, why do they send them among the Indians? If they are useful to the white people and do them good, why do they not keep them at home? The white men are surely bad enough to need the labor of everyone who can make them better. The missionaries know we do not understand their religion. We cannot read their book. They tell us different stories about what it contains, and we believe they make the book talk to suit themselves. If we had no money, no land, and no country to be cheated out of, these black coats would not trouble themselves about our good hereafter. The Great Spirit will not punish us for what we do not know. He will do justice to his red children. These black coats talk to the Great Spirit and ask for light that we may see as they do, when they are blind themselves and quarrel about the light that guides them. These things we do not understand, and the light which they give us makes the straight and plain path trod by our fathers dark and dreary. The black coats tell us to work and raise corn. They do nothing themselves and would starve to death if someone did not feed them. All they do is pray to the Great Spirit, but that will not make corn and potatoes grow. If it will, why do they beg from us and from the white people? The red men knew nothing of trouble until it came from the white men. As soon as they crossed the great waters, they wanted our country, and in return have always been ready to teach us to quarrel about their religion. Red Jacket can never be the friend of such men. If the Indians were raised among white people and learned to work and read as they do, it would only make their situation worse. We are few and weak, but may for a long time be happy if we hold fast to our country and the religion of our fathers.
Garanyak Taje gave a fairly detailed account of how the Six Nation Confederacy was formed. The Garanyanegu, a sub-chief of the Wolf Clan, told me about the councils held by the people of the Longhouse. Before we hear that explanation, I want to point out two things. First, everyone has a voice in the council. Everyone, including children. Second, the only decisions handed down from the council are unanimous decisions. It's been said that many of the basic features in the United States Constitution were borrowed from the Longhouse. It might be a good idea to borrow some more from this type of government, a government that's truly of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Our people are divided up into 9 clans. And in our councils, each family is represented by a chief. You have 9 Mohawk chiefs in the Mohawk Nation. And I'm sitting in for one of them under the Wolf Clan. When we have our council, a certain problem arises among our people, then it goes through what we call the People's Council, and they talk about this problem. After they have come to a conclusion, then they call a chief's meeting, and they have to go by the wishes of the people. And also, if the chiefs find something wrong in whatever they passed in a people's meeting, that the chiefs will correct it. Our chiefs are instructed to look seven generations into the future to make sure that our children and grandchildren will have a place to live and exercise their way of life. The clan mother holds an important position. She is the one that picks the chief through her people, her family. And if a chief does anything wrong, she warns him. And if he keeps on doing wrong, then she deposes him. And her family will pick out another chief. And if a chief is deposed, nobody will listen to him anymore.
Having been raised in a society whose power for the most part is held by men, it was good to hear about the control and government exercised by the women in the Confederacy. This was especially so after Ozit Nwanyo, the Turtle Clan mother, told me why this responsibility was given to women.
It seemed that the men had, I suppose, had known that in some areas of life itself that there are some things that women know more about when it comes to families or raising children, or they're with the children most of the time, and they can see how children develop, if a child is more capable of one thing or another, or, you know, this type of thing. And that they did, you know, see that in some areas of life that women were wiser with some, and they'd go to them for some advice too, just as men are more capable of certain things than women. They both work together. There's equal status amongst the Confederacy people, because I guess too then the women is, if you live by nature disciplines you. You know, like you've got to do certain things when it's time. Say, for instance, when it's time to plant, you can't wait till months later. If you want anything for the fall, you're going to have to do it when it's time, you know, and so on. So the earth is our life. It provides for us, and life comes from the woman. And this is why the men did, do respect the women in those, that they are the bearer of their children, and that's the respect, you know, for the earth all the way around.
And that respect is also evident in the way a clan mother is appointed.
Usually you're selected by other women, usually the older women in the community. You know, naturally, it just stands to reason, we go to our older people for advice because they had the experience of living. And age itself is wisdom. Older people are really important to us. As compared to white society, a lot of white people, they ignore the elders and, you know.
And coming back here to Ganyog, our territory, it's all these things that we almost lost, that we're trying to regain. It was hard back on reservations to practice these things, because our way of life is disrupted by outside forces. Each family is for themselves. But here it's all together as one in this community. We all eat in one place and we share everything here. But back on reservation, we couldn't do this. It was just like any other community. But our people, they don't understand what was happening out there to them. until some people started finding out what was causing alcoholics, drug, all these things. They decided that if they went back home to their territory and exercised what they know, what was handed down, then everything would be well again. So people with their families and friends came in and reclaimed their territory. There was treaties made with the United States government, with our people. And our people are still upholding these treaties. But to us, still the treaty is good. But to the United States, it's just a piece of paper. But now that we know that he doesn't want no part of the treaties, we just have to go back and take a chance and live the life that we're supposed to. So we're really committed to whatever we're doing here. And our children and our people are learning back their traditional ways. It's going to be a long, hard process. But I think it's going to be worth it.
They made their move on May 13, 1974. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, during a rainstorm, they arrived at Ginyange. The Mohawks left from different points. Kagwilegelu told me that only 4 scouts and no one else knew exactly what part of Mohawk land would be reclaimed. Their territory covers most of upstate New York and part of Vermont. The reason for the secrecy was to prevent authorities from learning their destination.
Later we discovered that this was a good plan because we found out that the state, New York State Police, were informed and that they were trying to follow our people to see where we were going, but somehow our people lost them. We also know or understand, although it's never been totally verified, that the state troopers in the state of Vermont were waiting for our people to cross the border, and they were going to try to stop our people.
The actual site of the Ginyange settlement is an abandoned girls' camp which the state of New York bought with the intent of tearing down the buildings and letting the land go back to its natural form. The Mohawk scouts who looked over the area didn't get many details on it because they didn't want to take a chance on being discovered. So when everyone arrived at Ginyange, they found an unexpected advantage.
Everyone was surprised, including the scouts, that there were so many buildings. We knew there were, well, there would be a barn, there would be a couple of buildings, and we knew we would need these because we brought a lot of older people and we brought a lot of children. And a lot of young babies came into Ginyange the first day, the first morning. And we knew we'd need to provide shelter for them. We also brought along some teepees, and we brought along camping tents, and we brought along material in which to build new buildings. And so we were all very surprised to see, you know, how many buildings there were here. That it was a former girls' camp and that a lot of buildings have been set up further in where you cannot see them from the road.
Where the settlement now stands is not as remote as its inhabitants would like it to be. But all in all, it seems to be the best location for it at this time.
The fact that buildings were here and that there were some areas where we could plant, because we planted as soon as we got here, worked out very well because our people are in what is, we'd have to call, a transitional period. A lot of people came from established reservations and some people came from urban areas. And it would have been very difficult for people to change from that environment, suddenly be set up right in the middle of the woods, you know, without no protection and no buildings whatsoever.
When the people first came to Ginyange, they brought along a lot of dried food like beans and corn in case they were besieged by authorities. Fortunately, though, no such action was taken. Some suggested that the state was hoping the Indians would tire of their endeavor and leave quietly. However, the Mohawks make it clear that they're very serious in this effort, and they'll go through with it at any cost. They also make it clear that they're the ones who hold legal and Aboriginal title to the land.
People sometimes wonder, you know, well, what right do Indian people have to, you know, our Mohawk people feel we have to be here? Well, first of all, I've got to remind everyone that our people were here thousands and thousands of years before the Europeans came here. And that our people had certain territories, certain lands that we lived upon. Our people stood for 150 bloody years between the British and the French when both were trying to get domination, you know, over our lands. And although they were successful in acquiring a lot of the lands on the East Coast and, you know, taking them away from the Indian people there, they never were able to get any lands away from the Six Nations Confederacy. And for 150 years, you know, we were successful in keeping both the French and the British from taking over our lands. Then along came the American Revolution, and now the 13 colonies rebelled against Great Britain. And they fought for the 13 colonies, which was still outside of our lands. And New York State at that time was only, I believe, 9 counties on the Hudson, and only on the southern, you know, southern part of the Hudson River. And that was New York State at the time of the American Revolution. And although the American Revolution spilled over, you know, onto our lands, and a lot of our towns and our villages were burnt and destroyed by the Americans, and other Indian nations had their towns and villages destroyed. When the American Revolution ended in 1783, and King George III surrendered to the United States, the Six Nations Indian people were still militarily in control of all their lands and territories, from New York State down through Pennsylvania, all the way down to the Carolinas and west to the Mississippi. And Congress of the United States had to decide what were they going to do. That they had just finished a long, hard war with Great Britain. They were successful, but now they were low on ammunition, low on money, low on supplies. And they decided that they could not afford an all-out Indian war, you know, to fight the Six Nations and all the other allies. And so they decided to sue the Six Nations for peace. So a year later, in 1784, the Six Nations agreed to enter peace treaties with the United States. And what these treaties were to set boundary lines that separated the United States from the lands of the Six Nations Confederacy. And it's even worded in these treaties that these treaties secured forever the lands that the Indian people, the Six Nations people, lived on. It didn't give them any lands because no one had ever taken their lands away. It just set once and for all boundary lines. And there were three treaties, and they came about because, you know, the last two treaties came about mainly because settlers of New York State kept violating the boundary lines. And in 1794, when Tecumseh and the other Western Indian nations were uniting to try to drive the United States right back into the Atlantic Ocean, they came to the Six Nations Confederacy and asked the Six Nations to join them. George Washington heard of this, and he came personally into the Six Nations territory and reminded the Six Nations that they had a peace treaty and they had agreed, you know, to be forever at peace with the United States. The Six Nations, chiefs of the Six Nations, again reminded George Washington that it was his people that had been violating the treaties. So George Washington entered into the final peace treaty between the United States and the Six Nations in 1794, and pledged his solemn word that the United States would never again violate these sovereign treaties. Of course, today in 1976, we know this not to be so, that the United States did violate not only the Six Nations treaties, but in all 371 treaties that were made between the United States and Indian nations throughout what today is called continental United States. So these lands are still ours. They're still ours according to treaty agreements. They still belong to us. They've always belonged to us. And just the fact that our people have kind of been governments in exile. Our people have maintained their governments, have maintained their language and their religion and everything else that makes a people and makes a nation. But we've been more or less governments in exile, or actually within our own country, within our own territory. And today, or rather, 1974, our Mohawk people decided that, well, we're going to go back and we're going to occupy and we're going to start living in our own lands.
It was something that had been talked about for too long a time for me anyway. The whole idea of getting a territory was long in our minds before the actual planning of Ganyonge. Many years before, was talked about very strongly then about gaining an area of land. That would be the only solution to all the problems to solve our own, problems, really. And that's why we're here. It wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing for me.
It wasn't hard. Maybe it was about the easiest decision I ever made.
This is Joke Wanoro. He left his farm, which he'd been developing for the past 5 years, to bring his family to Ganyonge. The idea of reclaiming a part of stolen Mohawk territory had long been in his mind, too.
Since, I don't know, maybe about six, seven years old, I've been always hearing this, we got land. Why don't we get it back? That's all I've been hearing. All that while, so when we got that evictions and they had arrested some of us and thrown us in jail, they said they weren't gonna bother anybody. That's why I never listened to what they say. 'Cause just about everything they say is all lies, just twisted. So the government wouldn't do nothing. So, and they wanted us to fight among each other, ourselves. That's when this idea came back. He said, we'll go someplace where our grandfathers came from.
The only claim that New York State has to this land was, after they settled it and they took, they just took over parts of it, they went and got a man by the name of Joseph Brant from who was then living in what is called Canada. And this Joseph Brant was raised by Sir William Johnson and was sent to England to go to school, and he was brought up as a Britisher, even though he was born an Indian. And so he had no rights whatsoever in the Mohawk Nation or the Six Nation Confederacy. He was not a chief. He had no title whatsoever. He had no right whatsoever to these lands. But he went ahead and he signed an agreement that claims to have given all of the Mohawk territories to New York State.
That treaty was no good because he went on his own without the Six Nation knowing. And he sold the land for $1,000. 9 million acres. $1,000. So everything that has to be, when you make a treaty, it has to be between governments. United States government and the Six Nation government. So this was just the state and one single person.
This is contrary to the Constitution of the United States, because the Constitution of the United States says that no individual state can make a treaty with a foreign power, with a separate power. And it's illegal according to that. It's illegal according to the Constitution of Six Nation Confederacy. In order for any land transactions to be made, the whole Six Nations Confederacy must agree to it, and they must, put their signature to it, and which they never did. The Mohawk Nation itself did not agree. It was just one single man who had no power whatsoever. And this is the only claim you know, New York State has to it. And if this were to be taken up before a world court, before an international forum, or anywhere where there would be an impartial and unbiased ruling. But we are making some distinctions in that we did not occupy privately owned land. Within the 9 million acres of land that still belongs to the Mohawk Nation, about 6 million acres of that, approximately 6 million acres of that, is what is called the Adirondack Forest Preserve. And within that forest preserve, there's almost 3 million acres of unoccupied, unused land that is not in private ownership whatsoever, but so-called public land. And it is this land that we moved on, and it is this kind of land that we want restored to us, so that we don't interfere unnecessarily with the rights of private ownership or people who really are not responsible for, you know, for the land being taken away from our people. But what we must remind people now is that it is this generation of people who are responsible what happens now. You know, that's going to affect the future generations of our people and of non-Indian people. The way traditional Indian people are brought up is that everything is alive. You know, the trees are alive, the animals are alive, a leaf is alive, you know, the waters, the fish, these are all living things. And therefore deserve a mutual respect, you know, from Indian people, or from all people. Now, these people that are cutting these logs down, these companies, they're doing it solely for profit, you know. You know, it's a big profit thing, make as much money as they can. Our people are doing it for just, you know, for mere survival, to heat our homes and to cook our food and to build our homes, and not much more than that, do a little bit of our craft work. When we take animals for food, you know, when we take a deer or a rabbit or anything, these are living things, and therefore they deserve a respect. And so our people give thanks to them. They give apology. We burn tobacco for them, and we have a special ceremony for these things. But I doubt if anyone feels that way when a forest company, a lumber company, cuts down trees, or when in the stockyards they slaughter beef cattle, you know, to supply to, you know, to the general population. So I think in the long run we tend to, you know, not to abuse, you know, abuse the forest and not to abuse the animals, because we are taught to respect these things, just running water.
Another extra responsibility that everyone at Kanyange must take on is keeping certain people from entering the main part of the settlement. Two groups are in that category: any Indians not obeying the laws of Kanyange, and all non-Indians. The obvious reason, of course, is security.
There are a lot of people who do not want to see us here and want to have us evicted. And so the less non-Indian people come in, the more, you know, secure we are. But I think even more importantly is that since we came back here to re-educate ourselves and to educate our children in the traditional lifestyles, that the less outside influence that ourselves and our children are subjected to, the easier it will be, the quicker it will be for them to return, you know, to the traditional ways and values that we came back here for. Our, you know, as Indian people, our doors have always been open, you know, to outside people, to visitors. And we opened our doors when the pilgrims and the settlers first came here. And the next thing we knew, they went right through to the Pacific Ocean and really left nothing for us. And so if we're going to, you know, regain some of what we lost, we're going to have to, you know, try to do it, you know, in this way as much as possible. You know, once the day comes when we get the respect that from all people, you know, that they are not going to come into our lands and are not going to ridicule our lifestyle, and they're not going to try to impose their own lifestyle upon us, and you know, not going to come here to kind of justify in their own minds that their lifestyle is superior to ours. You know, once people can give us mutual respect, once there's a mutual respect from both sides, once that becomes possible, then we'll be able to relax those restrictions. And unfortunately, it seems like that's still quite a distance in the future.
And that was the Pacifica documentary Ganyenke, done in 1976. In 1977, the state of New York awarded them 600 acres and put them into a far northeast corner of the state. Far short of the 3 to 6 million acres they were seeking, but it's a start. The fight is ongoing. Right now, the families living in Ganyenke have established an organic farm, livestock, holistic health center, zero tolerance for alcohol and drugs, and an ongoing preservation and reacquisition campaign. This program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer, and the series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and I've been your host, Brian DeShazer. We'd like to thank Tim McGovern, the original producer of today's program, for helping us select this as part of the National Endowment for the Arts Grant Preservation Project. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, and past grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and partnerships with UC Berkeley's Moffitt Library, and from Pacifica Station members. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our Native American history alive.